Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. We are about to have a conversation about automobiles, but not probably the one you're driving in at this moment. Maybe some of you are. But about electric cars and their future and their possibilities now. So we'll come back to that in just a moment. But first, let's turn this over to WEA Traffic, check on the roads, whether you're in your electric car, your hybrid car, or your gas-guzzling big, gigantic car. We're going to make sure you're safe. We'll be right back, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Before we begin, I want to remind you that the documentary Not Just a Game, which is a documentary about sports and politics by writer David Zirin, who was on the show recently talking about it, you've heard him on the show many, many times, is being screened tonight at 7:30 p.m. at 2640 St. Paul Street. That's tonight at 7:30, 2640 St. Paul Street. Dave Zirin will be there for question and answer to present his film. It's a fundraiser for the Outdoor Project and the United Workers. So enjoy the evening, good people, great film. And Dave is a real entertaining person when he talks. So enjoy that. 7:30 tonight, 2640 St. Paul Street. The topic for this first hour of the Mark Steiner Show is electric cars. I have been a fan of the electric car for a long time. I remember in 1996 when the EV1 came out in California and Arizona. General Motors put it out. I know General Motors is on the show today, so I'm not going to bash General Motors here, but General Motors put it out. They quickly decided that this could be dangerous. No matter, Tom Hanks had one, and everybody was out there. He was on David Letterman with it. I remember all that going on, and it became a real kind of swell of the moment, but I think also a great threat on some levels to the auto industry, a great threat as well to the oil industry and the companionship thereof, and it was squashed, killed, destroyed, and those cars were gone. But it's coming back, and I think the clearly our reliance on foreign oil is bringing it back to center stage. There are companies around the country that are beginning to build electric cars, some of our major manufacturers, as well as new ones like Tesla. We're going to talk about the feasibility, possibility of those automobiles being in mass production and circulation in our world. Our state is kind of at the head of the curve here, trying to push this. We are joined this hour by four guests. Kristen Zimmerman, she's a member of the Volt infrastructure team at the General Motors Research and Development, and Volt is the electric car GM is putting out. Mahi Reddy is CEO of SemaConnect. We'll hear about that in a moment. He's in the studio with us. Jill Sorensen is director of the Electric Vehicle Initiative for Baltimore, Washington, D.C., BEVI, as it's known. And Charlie Garlow is an electric vehicle builder on his own and a longtime electric vehicle proponent and a BEVI board member. So Kristen, Mahi, Jill, and Charlie, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. And I'm thinking about that as you're driving around the traffic. Imagine yourself in an electric vehicle. Now, let's take this little fantasy trip for a minute. What would that mean right now if I asked my listeners who are driving around their cars and imagining they're in this electric vehicle? How would that be different? How would it be different if half of the people swirling around the Beltway and riding up and down Charles Street and out here on Lock Raven Boulevard or would be in electric vehicles?
It wouldn't really be that different, Mark. I mean, after all, they've got all the conveniences of modern cars. They've got air conditioning. They've got radios, XM radio, whatever you need. Cup holders. They're smooth, slick, good suspension. What's not to like? It's just that they don't use oil. And
that's what's to like.
Yeah, that's the good part. They don't pollute the earth. But from a driver's perspective, it really is pretty transparent.
Would you agree with that, Kristen?
I would add the fun, the excitement of driving this vehicle. It's very, very high tech. It doesn't need to necessarily be that high tech at the interface. But the driver immediately notices the noise of the other vehicles. It's quiet. It's smooth. And it's just so very different driving a battery electric vehicle or a plug-in electric vehicle than your traditional internal combustion engine vehicle.
So we each have a little something to add.
Jill Sorensen.
I have had the pleasure to test drive at least a Toyota Prius plug-in hybrid for a while, and I equate the experience to spaceship-like. It is quiet. It's comfortable. You get great pickup. also, for me, I have a tendency to be a little bit of a lead foot, and I found myself with the control panels and the read back. Yes, I drove differently. I drove more carefully. I was thinking about the energy efficiency and how I was wasting energy, if I'm being inefficient, because you've got that. For me, it was how are you driving kind of informatics right at the dashboard. I think I was a better driver.
Mahi.
Yeah, I think electric vehicles, I mean, I think as Charlie said, they're quiet, they're non-polluting, and it's just a sheer joy to drive, you know. That's what's different from driving electric cars as opposed to, you know, your gasoline-fueled cars.
Now, there is another thing I would point out. At our drag races we hold each year as part of the Electric Vehicle Association of D.C., of which I'm an officer, we have vehicles that can take off real fast.
They are fast when they get up.
Electric vehicles deliver peak torque right away.
Right.
So you're quick off the line if you want to be. If you'd rather be more efficient, like Jill was suggesting, you can do that too.
When I sat in my friend's Tesla and he said, "What's this torque?" and put his foot on the pedal, I was impressed.
It's scary almost in the Tesla. They are so quick. It's jolts you back into your seat, doesn't it? Got that need for speed? Not a problem. They've got it for you.
Well, let's talk a bit about where we are in all seriousness about the electric cars and the history of this. And I think that you all kind of come from this at different angles. Major manufacturing, promoting it in this community. You've been an advocate for years pushing this and also driving and building cars, which we want to hear about. And Mahi, your program of actually putting in the stations. Mm-hmm. That's the business you're building, right? Putting in
Absolutely. The
stations so people can charge their cars.
Right. These are the gas pumps for electric cars. And, you know, just as without gas pumps, the internal combustion engine car wouldn't go very far. So our concept is as much as you need electric cars, you need the infrastructure to spring up simultaneously.
And so tell us about your company. What are you intending to do?
Right. So we're a startup company, and essentially what we're building is something that we call network charging infrastructure, right? What is network charging infrastructure? When you get an electric car, the thing is, you know, unlike with your gasoline-fueled car where you pull into this dedicated spot and you gas up, with an electric car it takes, you know, between 2 to 4 hours to charge up, right? So what is the right place to charge these cars? That really would be where your car is parked. And your car is parked at home. It's parked when you go to your office. So really the fueling stations, these gas pumps, need to be in your home. They need to be in office parking lots, transit parking lots, and so on. So what we're trying to do is we've built the technology that will enable you to go anywhere, plug in anywhere, wave a smart card, and be able to charge up your car.
Now, what came to my mind, because this is how I think, and I will just throw it out here for a moment, as soon as I thought about this. I mean, when you think about the idea of having an electric car, and you can plug in at night at your home, it took the Tesla 3 or 4 hours to fully charge. They go, I think right now, 250 miles per charge, something like that, if I'm correct.
Unless you're doing Charlie's driving. Sorry.
Oh, that's quite all right. You can get less mileage if you really want to. Some people have gotten 300 miles on a charge with a Tesla, but
And people are worried about that because they want to make sure that they get from place to place, and because that is adequate for most city driving that we do. But I could see and have seen the opposition coming from oil companies, because if this really took off, it would change the economic infrastructure of the nation in many ways. Because you wouldn't be spending $50 to fill up your gas tank, which you do now when you pull into a gas station. Even my little Honda takes $50 to fill it up or more, and probably more soon. This would be a charge. You could have it here on the parking lot at Morgan State University, little charges all over the place, and you have charge at your house, charge at the supermarket, especially if you're going to an office. You go to your office, you park, and you plug in all day long, charge the car, come out, it's charged, and you're heading home. So that in some ways is a boon, but also a threat and a change in the entire economic infrastructure of America in many ways.
Well, you should also point out, instead of the $50 for the tank full, electricity costs about one quarter of the cost of gasoline at $3 or $3.50 a gallon for gasoline, like 75 cents a gallon equivalent, which is cheap at double the price. And so that'll affect the economics of the situation. I think that's a real plus for electric vehicles.
It's a plus, but I'm saying that, I think that that's part of the – I think the opposition and the kind of reluctance, the reticence to really push ahead is that it does change the nature of the auto industry and it changes the nature of – gas and oil in America.
Well, you'll certainly get some pushback from the oil companies, for sure.
And there are other dimensions to the economics. Our gasoline tax fuels a lot of our road repair.
Right,
and so we have to be thinking about consequences. If you remove that source of revenue, then who maintains the conditions of the roads? That's a real consideration. Places like the state of Washington have proposed a $100 fee. What do we call them today? Maybe not a tax, but a fee. I'm not sure what Washington's calling it, but trying to anticipate that populations out there would favor electric vehicles and they'd want to make up for the revenue loss. It's important, though, to keep in mind, what are the numbers like? We were talking a little earlier about 247 million vehicles on the
cars on the road, and more when you total all the vehicles in America and trucks and everything else on the road.
And so over what period of time are we looking at this transition? For those of us who are EV enthusiasts, we'd say more transition sooner, and we'll work through those economics and we'll do our modeling. But I think it'll take a while to see penetration.
So, I mean, Kristen Amahi, then we'll go to Kristen. I mean, so what about the economics of this thing? So you have this great idea, I mean, this of pushing having these stations wherever you go to plug in your car. But what's the economic model that makes it work?
Yeah, I mean, to go back to Charlie's remark, you know, if you charge your car on, you know, with electricity, it's like paying 3 cents a mile as opposed to paying 12 to 15 cents a mile with gasoline, right? So now that's a tremendous spread. And I think it's on the basis of that spread that you really will make the economics work for electrically powered cars, right? So if I were, for example, if I were a building owner, let's say an apartment building owner, I would install charging stations, and I would bill my tenants maybe $100 or $125 a month for an all-you-can-eat plan, right? Now, on the electricity, I would spend maybe $30 to $40. So I've got this profit margin that enables me to get some kind of a payback on the charging stations. And so I think that, you know, at this point, we're still discovering all of the right business models within each one of these environments. But I have no doubt that that will, gain traction very rapidly.
So, Kristen, have you all discussed that at General Motors?
Certainly. And, you know, I really do think that the economics will be defined and driven by the customer in this space. They are now given a choice that they really did not have. For so many years, they were beholden to go to the gas station and fill up their car with fuel, petroleum, gasoline typically in this market versus diesel fuel. Now they're given a choice, and we've got this wonderful interdependency now as an automotive OEM in producing essentially load demand on the electricity part of the market. And therefore, this interdependency allows the utilities, and most particularly the distribution part of the utility systems, to take a look at demand-side management, demand response. How do we really add more value to the market and the customer in that sense, because they own that same customer that the auto OEM is selling the vehicle to. So there's some new dynamics, and I really do believe that the customer is at the kind of the integral point of defining what that's going to look like going forward. And yes, as Jill pointed out, it's going to take time for enough of these plug-in capable vehicles to saturate the market to really impact some of these other things on road taxes and such. It's on the radar screen, but it will take time before you see it really making an impact and displacing the vehicles that are in the market today.
There's an interesting point. What Kristen raises is in terms of consumer choice, if you're driving a Volt, extended range electric vehicle, what's nice about strategically their choice is, and in the context of consumer driven, you can favor electric. And if you are driving too much and you didn't get the opportunity to recharge, well, you rely on the gas recharging your battery. And so you can, you know, choose to not drive and not do that, or favor the electric, or make some other kind of a switch. But the beauty of the Volt in particular and having both of those options is the consumer can, you know, depending on how diligent you are, make those choices. What does my day look like? What sort of transportation needs do I have? And how can I or can I favor the electric?
Sure. For a long time, if the gasoline prices went to $4 a gallon, we had no choice. You had to had to pay. You were over the barrel, so to speak. But now Volt owners and others could say, well, I'll tend to favor the electric side. I will be more diligent about making sure I'm charging up and using my grid electricity rather than the gasoline-supplied electricity. So you got a choice.
Right.
And we're seeing that. It's exciting. We're seeing that already in the market with the individuals purchasing the Volt. I actually drive one myself. And are commuting to work during the work week on pure battery, and then might take an occasional longer drive on the weekends alone. So there's a bit of peer pressure and comparison on the blogosphere saying, you know, I've only burned half a gallon of fuel, and I've owned my vehicle for months, let's say. So it's creating this wonderful peer pressure, and I think it is absolutely customer choice driven.
Right. And electricity prices also, another factor that we really need to, I think, sort of take into account is that over the long term, electricity prices are very stable, unlike the price of gasoline, right? I mean, gasoline, just in the last 2 years, it went from $40 a barrel to $140, and then it dipped back to close to $60. It's now right, it started to move, heading back toward $140. That creates a very unpredictable a situation for both consumers as well as automobile companies, right? Whereas with electricity, over the long term, they're much more stable, they're predictable, and that gives you the ability to, really plan your usage much better.
Number is 410-319-8888. Have you thought about electric vehicles? Are you willing to change into one? What does that mean to change into an electric vehicle instead of your gas machine that we all drive? I drive one. Your thoughts on what that might mean for the future, your questions about it, 410-319-8888. We have in studio Jill Sorensen, who's director of the Electrical Vehicle Initiative for Baltimore and Washington, BEVI, Charlie Garlow, who's one of their board members. Also, he builds his own electric vehicles. Mahi Reddy is CEO of SemiConnect, which would put up the battery stations, the plug-ins, the place where you plug in your electric car once we get them started. And he's already doing them in some locations that we'll talk about. Kristen Zimmerman is a member of the Volt Infrastructure Team at General Motors Research and Development, joining us by phone. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And I think things are market-driven, but what people want, but they're also driven by the people who run the market. And they're not always the consumer. In other words, advertising plays a big role in what we think we like and what we think we want. And so many things, we buy stuff that we don't really want because it looks good when we watch it on television, so we're going to buy one of those things. The other part of it is demand can be created by places like the government. Some people hate the government. Some people love the government. The government, if it is the people's institution, then you like it. But that if that institution were to say, as I said to you all before we went on the air, by the year 2020, half of all the vehicles that we are going to use for the United States government or X number of state governments will be electric, or we won't buy them from you. Now, that would change the market.
Sure would. President Obama's doing a pretty good job. He's been a booster for electric vehicles. We've got this $7,500 tax credit you can get for buying a new electric vehicle. That sure helps. He's called for 1 million electric vehicles by 2015.
Out of 143? Out of 250? Whatever it is?
Hey, it's a great first step. And some people are poo-pooing it, saying, whatever. They always want to attack him for something. They're saying, oh, he's being overly optimistic. Hey,
right.
Go for it.
He dithers.
I'm
he
cheering
doesn't.
For
he
him.
Does, But that would change the marketplace immediately.
But it's a bipartisan thing, too. I mean, there's a lot of Republicans as well as Democratic governors and others around the states that are promoting electric vehicles.
Yeah, for important reasons. I mean, it's on the one hand, you have people that, that are supporting this for climate change reasons and so on. But you've also got, conservatives lined up here because, if you look at the economic security of our country, the energy security of our country, I think this is it is key. Transportation, we're very vulnerable, and we really need to get off of our dependence on fossil fuels.
Go ahead, then I'll open the phones. A lot of people are calling in. I want to get them in on the conversation. Wayman and Annette, you're the first two callers up. We're going to come to you right now as soon as we have a comment from Jill Sorensen.
Just a quick note. A lot of what BEVI is doing is what we call market conditioning, which relates to a point you're making, and that is expectations. How do people, consumers, see themselves? Young people, you know, people in their 20s and 30s, what kind of a vehicle do you want to be driving? For a lot of years, it was really a strong perception that Americans liked and needed big cars. Why has that changed? Why do we think that we can make that adjustment? Well, you see some of the climate change that we've been dealing with, and I think that it's a little bit more apparent for us to be appreciating what is the impact of all the
right.
CO2 emission.
It's also, you know, the one thing you say, and I do go right to Wayman, is that that's what I was alluding to earlier. If you look at the rest of the world, we're about the only country that has gigantic vehicles on our roads. I mean, we might think we want – I mean, when we watch a football game, we're told we want that big, gigantic truck.
Right.
That's, I mean, I did that advertising for years, and you know, this is for 3 years. And we are informed that that's what we really want, as opposed to what we really want is this little thing that's a much smaller car that can do everything we wanted to do, or an electric four-wheel drive vehicle that can get us through the snow just as well as a gasoline-powered four-wheel drive vehicle. I mean, that's what I'm saying, that it's not just what we want, it's also what we – the tug and pull between what we're told we want
mm-hmm.
in this world,
mm-hmm.
you know? Anyway, 410-319-8888. Wayman on 695, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you guys doing today?
Real well, welcome.
Well, my question is, how easy is it to maintain an electric car when, in terms of getting the accidents and repairs and things of that nature? And my other comment is, what would prevent the price of electricity skyrocketing? And I know that diesel, when I was younger, was a lot cheaper than regular gas. And now diesel is more than regular gas. And I know that within the last, say, 5 or 6 years, just the cost of gas and electric has seemed to jump dramatically. I know BG&E recently jumped 30-40% in terms of the cost of gas and electric. So I'm curious of what things would prevent the drastic increase in electricity, as well as how hard is it to maintain an electric car. Is it the same as a regular gas-powered car, or is it more difficult?
Two really good questions. Let's talk about the cost of electricity first, because that could skyrocket.
Well, yes, it could. But the thing is, at this point, you know, we have a huge amount of electricity generation infrastructure already in place. It's estimated that even if 75% of all our automobiles convert to electric, we still have enough grid capacity. The thing is, it's how you intelligently use this grid capacity. If you put all these cars charging at, 11 a.m. in the morning, you're going to really stress out the grid. You're going to have to make some difficult choices. But if you have intelligent charging infrastructure, if you've got intelligent cars that talk to the grid and then figure out the optimal charging times, we can actually, with our current grid, without adding a lot of costs, we can actually be able to charge all of these cars.
Yeah, if you charge a lot of the electric vehicles at midnight when the grid is not being used, those power plants are not being used, that makes the economics of the electric utility industry much better. Our electricity could end up being cheaper because we're more intelligently using the power plants that we have, so the price of electricity could even go down rather than skyrocket.
It could, but the chances of the market seeing an opportunity and having it not go up are slim.
Most of the time things go up. You're right, Mark.
I mean, I think that way that He had a point there. And then the other part of that is that we can talk about a little later, is that the way we get our electricity in this country, over half of it comes from coal, which is one of the great destroyers of our atmosphere and environment as well. I mean, so there are a lot of trade-offs in this process. That doesn't mean things ultimately can change. I mean, clearly it's moving in the right direction.
Right.
That's why a lot of electric vehicle advocates are also advocates of renewable energies like solar and wind, because the sun comes to you free. Once you've got your solar panels, you've got your own electricity, you got it made.
Well, let me turn to Kristen and Charlie here to answer the second part of the question, if that's okay, just about how to maintain and fix electric vehicles. Because my sense of watching a mechanic fix my friend's Tesla or come to service it at his house was it's a much simpler piece of machinery than all of the cars we got under when we were younger. So let me start with Kristen, then we'll go to Charlie.
Sure, and just to say a couple words to this
cost containment for electricity. You know, you've got regulated markets. You have some that are non-regulated. If they're regulated, they'll take time through rate casing and this kind of thing for any price to go up. And if indeed we are smart charging our vehicles, such as delayed charging or delayed based on electricity rate and charging off-peak, we are adding such efficiency to the electricity provider at distribution as well as generation side that their costs are coming down greatly, and the regulator sees that. So there is a little bit of cost containment built into that side of the model. Now on maintenance and repair,
I
think you touched on the fact there are far fewer moving parts.
A lot fewer.
And it's going to be a lot less burden on the customer in terms of typical maintenance and repair. That's what we're seeing right now. For instance, oil change for the Chevy Bolt, maybe on the order of every 2 years. Think about that. Think about what that might displace. The Jiffy Lubes and the oil change centers,
right.
They're going to have to start to shift their business model. So everything's connected. But I think what the customer is going to find is that not only the fun to drive, but the typical maintenance and repair on these systems, these really intelligent systems, is very, very minimal. And the other key component is, could they also garner lower insurance rates? Because the drivers tend to be safer drivers, and indeed, if it does get in an accident, the cost for repair, because of the fewer moving parts, may be far lower. So there, again, a lot of key pieces to this puzzle.
Mark, I'd like to ask Waylon, have you ever had an electric drill in your workshop? You know, zing, zing, right away. When was the last time you had to have your muffler changed on that sucker? Never. How about an oil change? Never. How about a tune-up? Never. I mean, I've had mine for 20 or more years. I use it for pounding nails if I can't find my hammer. Electric motors are terrific. They hardly ever break down. And that's why? Because there's no explosion going on inside the internal combustion engine that would rip it apart, like happens with the gas cars that I've worked on ever since I was a kid. Now, my friends who are mechanics say, well, gee, Charlie, is there going to be any work left for us to do? Well, yeah, sure. I mean, you got shock absorbers, you got tires that need to be changed, all sorts of stuff still. But you are going to have a lot less work to be done there, and a lot of the major automobile manufacturers have as a profit center a lot of the repairs. So they're going to have to change their model of making money as well.
And it will be a transition. In 30 or 40 years, if electric vehicles take hold in America, there will be fewer mechanics, and there'll be fewer gas stations. But it'll be a slow process.
There are also fewer horse and buggy whip repair people now. You know, we're moving on.
But that's true. That is true. 410-319-8888. Annette, you're on the air.
So you all are making it sound like this is a practice choice that everybody can make, but there are an awful lot of people like me. I live in a townhouse. I don't have a garage. I don't have a driveway. So even though I want to purchase a new car within the next few months, it isn't even within the realm of possibilities of something that I would be practical for me to do. And I think millions of people who are similarly situated. So it's not really a choice for everybody at this time.
Well, hold on. Let's talk about it. You can remain with us for a minute before we go to our next caller. Who wants to grab this first? Mahi, please go ahead. Mahi, ready.
Annette, I think you really have a dilemma, and I really sympathize with that. But the thing is, this is the thing about intelligent charging infrastructure, right? Now, if we had a charging station that outside your townhome or condo that enabled your landlord, in effect, to have some kind of a revenue model, you know, he's able to give you a smart card, you're able to, wave it in front of it, plug your car in, charge, and and if he has a revenue model, then it's in his interest to make it happen for you. And I think that's what we're going to see. So for all of the people that live in apartment buildings or condos, I think you'll now have these landlords wake up and say, you know what, I'm not just going to collect rent from these people, I'm also going to be their gas station.
Well,
so that's a great opportunity.
Maybe Homeowners Association would have to do it, I mean.
Absolutely.
But, Maya, you're being understated because this is how you built out your business model, anticipating that only 50% of residents have a dedicated garage of their own. You built out, at least in part, your product to accommodate the other 50% that don't have that dedicated structure.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm completely focused on precisely this kind of a dilemma.
What were you saying, Annette? I'm sorry.
doesn't seem like something that I would be in a position to make that choice. It's not there for me at this point.
Right. I think that
any other people.
Right. Thanks so much. And I think that is the point. I mean, this is the transition part. I mean, it is not there a choice for many people. I mean, I know that that it's going to take a while to implement.
And that's why we need advocates, not only people like Annette, but us as well, to say, hey, I would like to buy one of these things. I'm going to go to my landlord and ask him to put in one of these deals, and he can make money on it, and I will save money on my fuel. And you can – all over America, people are going to be having those conversations, and we're going to see more SEMA Connect charging stations places.
We're going to take a break here, and then we'll go back to our callers at 410-319-8888. I mean, I think that one of the things is that what Annette's bringing up here, the practicality.
And also the design of Baltimore. Baltimore does have a lot of row houses. People don't have dedicated garages or alleys. And so it is a good point. We haven't really thought through for this particular venue, would we do more street parking? If you are one of those early adopters, is there some special accommodation where you can locate the charging station curbside possible?
It would change. You'd have to really revamp the infrastructure because this is supposed to be a city car in many ways. Gets people around. That's one of the beauties of it, that you have 300 miles of charge. You can do most of your city driving and then charge a car once a week or whatever that would be or more. But where do you plug it in?
Right.
This is row home. Right. This is a row home community. Right. We'll talk about that when we come back more. 410-319-8888. We're talking about electric vehicles. Join us with our four guests. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are talking about the electric cars in our future and in our present. Maryland is ahead of the curve, and two of those folks who are bringing it ahead of the curve are in the studio here with us. Mahi Reddy is CEO of SemaConnect, a company that is building and installing places to connect your electric vehicle. We'll hear more about that during the course of this next half hour. Joe Sorensen is director of the Electric Vehicle Initiative for Baltimore and Washington, D.C., known as BEVI. Charlie Garlow is a board member there, and an electric car builder and longtime electric vehicle proponent. And Kristen Zimmerman is a member of the Volt Infrastructure team at the General Motors Research and Development in Detroit, I take. Is that what you're calling it? Is that where you are?
Yes, it is.
In the Big D. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And before we go, Iris, your next caller up in Waverly. And I wanted to hear what you had to say, but she wants to raise again the issue of charging stations and how community stations associations might fit into that. I want to hear what she has to say about that. But one of the things we talked about was the cost. One of the prohibitive factors of buying an electric vehicle is the cost of the vehicle. Like, especially when in the beginning here in America, it was Tesla. And they're still selling vehicles, but their vehicles are six figures. The sedan they're building is $47,000. That's a lot of money. I mean, for most people in America, are not going to spend $47,000 on a car, whether it's electric or if it has a propeller. I mean, people are just not going to spend $47,000 on a car for the most part. So what about the cost? I'm going to turn first to Kristen, because that is one of the roadblocks, it seems.
Yeah, but if you look at the technology adoption curves with any new technology that hits the market, you know, first adopters, they'll pay the big bucks for things that are very, very new to the market. And over time, as demand grows, the price comes down. I think you're going to see that, and you're also going to see, you know, some of the subsystems, like the battery, and some of the other componentry, the costs thereof come down. And it's been very nice to have support in terms of the federal tax incentive, tax credit, $7,500 for battery electric vehicles and plug-in electric vehicles such as the Volt. That helps get, you know, a little bit of a kickstart on that top end or first end of the technology adoption curve. But clearly, as demand grows, that cost will come down over time, like it does with every new technology that hits the market.
Yeah, you remember how much the first cell phones cost? I mean, hundreds, yeah. And now they practically give them to you. You sign up on their plan.
But as we talked about during the break, Mahi, the battery is the cost. I mean, that's where the...
Right. Yeah, I mean, lithium batteries, I mean, that's the big innovation that's essentially happened. And that's happened because, you know, we've all now have adopted this whole digital lifestyle. So
right.
We carry a cell phone, we use our laptops. So, you know, lithium battery technology has really taken off over the last couple of decades.
Now,
that's the technology that's coming into the cars, right?
One of the things I told My grandson and some of other friends of his was they were talking about what to do as they what to study. I mean, I think that one of the opening areas in the planet over the next 40, 50 years will be in battery design and engineering, in how to make these things smarter, smaller, more efficient, more power for less money.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the waves of the future, I think.
And that is already happening in the sense, if you looked at this, if, for example, lithium-ion batteries, you know, on a per kilowatt-hour basis, they were priced at about $1,500 per kilowatt-hour a few years ago. That's now come down to somewhere between $500 and $800. In the next 2 to 3 years, we're looking at this coming down further to about maybe $250 a kilowatt-hour. At about that price point, when you walk into a dealer showroom, right, you will have an electric car, you will have an internal combustion engine car, you know, and they look the same except, and the nice thing is the price point will be the same. And that's when it'll make, you know, it's a no-brainer to select the electric car because it's so much easier to maintain, it's less polluting, and it's cheaper to run.
And, well, I'll come back to the batteries in a minute, but let's go to the phones, I promise. 410-319-8888. Iris, you're on the air.
Hello, how y'all doing?
Well, welcome.
Thank you. I want to thank you all for being on this cutting edge. There are, of course, these difficulties and these challenges, and I thank you all for being part of this breakthrough period. One of the things I heard Ms. Annette saying was that homeowners associations could look into getting battery charging stations for electric vehicles, and I live in Waverly and part of the Waverly Improvement Association, and I'm going to bring it up at our next meeting. Could we you know, look into getting a charging station in Waverly? Waverly's a pretty progressive neighborhood.
It is that.
Probably some people there already have electric vehicles. I can't afford one yet. Eventually would like to get one. And maybe, you know, that's something that other people in other areas of the city could do. I don't know how exactly the whole thing works, but maybe if there was one every other block or something, and once a week you just have to walk a little bit farther to your car, that's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm. So what about, let me turn to until Jill Sorensen might have a handle on this.
There are a couple of interesting points about the question that's raised or the comment and also rendering it very suitable for Baltimore, which is very neighborhood-friendly and association-friendly. So I could see what the caller is describing happening readily in Baltimore to address not just charging vehicles. And, yes, it is pretty early. We're going to see a limited number of vehicles coming onto the market. But one of the things that I get excited about is I describe that electric vehicles are multiple tiers of investment, the first tier being transportation, the second tier being a source of mobile power management. We think about tapping into the grid, which we worry about being ready to deliver electricity to repower our cell phones. And so I would envision associations being in the position by the kind of investments that the caller is referencing to fortify the grid. Kristen, on previous occasions, has talked about, just from one automotive manufacturer's perspective, perhaps we could be positioning generators or transformers that could fortify, render smarter and more reliable our grid and grid performance. So there are a couple of dimensions to be thinking about. But for starters, homeowners associations could make that investment and you know, depending on the size of the association, not for so significant of a cost.
Well, Iris, I would point out that at your homeowners association up there in Waverly, you can still plug into a regular old lamp socket type socket to get your electricity for most of the new cars that are coming on the market. Much as I like my good friend Amahi over here, who has a more sophisticated device which will charge things faster, it's not like you have to drive to some centralized location where you get one of these fancy things. A lot of the new cars that are being sold, like the Nissan and the Volt, will sell you one for your own house in your own garage that will be like SEMA Connect, charging at higher rates more quickly. So you don't have to have just one for the whole homeowners association, I wouldn't think.
Let me I want to get another call in here, but then I want to turn to Kristen and others in this panel about where we are right now with the electric vehicle. Who's producing them? How much do they cost? Where do you get them? How do you keep them going? But let's go to the phones first, get another call, and we'll do that. 410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
Hello. Good evening, gentlemen and young ladies.
Good evening. Hank.
It's a blessed day. This is the problem that I had. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I love it because, see, it would be beneficial for me to have an electric vehicle and transportation, especially more of a van type, right? But if we went electric, right, that means that we'd have no reason to fight no war, right? And they don't want that, right? Because that occupies us to leave other things. But then the mechanics say they don't want it, but most of the times when you go to a mechanic, they tell you, go ahead and junk it and get a new car. It's not worth fixing, right? Because, see, that's what I'm saying is they tell you it's not worth having when they you see the benefits of having it. Just imagine if you took your own home and had solar panels on your home. Now you don't have to pay the electric company as much, and you can afford to have your own car and charge your own car. See, they don't want that, right? They don't want us not to tear up our own world so our world doesn't destroy us. That's all I'm saying, Mark.
Hank, I appreciate you.
Yeah. And by the way, my regular rider says that electric cars were out before combustion cars were out.
Well, let's take both those things. I mean, I think that there is, always has been, and continues to be, a real opposition from a lot of some of the corporate sector to electric cars for some of the reasons I think Hank was talking about, because it just changed the economic dynamic of this country, and it's very threatening.
What Kristen mentioned earlier is true. Everything is related, and so you can't just pluck one sort of vehicle out and not be thinking about the impact. But for those of us who champion EVs, it is a lovely thought to think about being more energy independent one home at a time. And that's happening beyond transportation. I mean, people really are thinking about, and there are other providers of technologies producing, like Nexus Energy Homes in Annapolis, Net Zero Energy Homes, an interesting project in Frederick, Maryland. We start to take a look at opportunities, and we can imagine other degrees of independence. But we are related to the utility companies and collectively to neighborhoods. And
yeah, it could be a battle royal against oil companies who don't want to see this happen, but I'm up for the fight. Hey, let's go. Bring it on.
Well, what about the history of this? Let's tell a little bit of history, then we'll talk about where we are at present. The history that Hank just raised, which we talked about during the break, which was that, I mean, in the turn of the century, automobiles were first being invented, there were a lot of electric vehicles. That was the name of the game. And that changed where the combustion engine was cheaper to produce. Am I right about that? Or wrong about
Henry
that?
Henry Ford and Thomas Edison were getting together on electric cars. And the gas cars won out for a number of reasons. I think one of them was distance, range, that you could drive the gasoline car because the gasoline has more energy packed into a smaller space than the batteries did back then.
Kristen, you want to jump in on that since you are in that business?
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned earlier even, you know, the evolution of the EV1.
Right.
And, you know, for General Motors, the EV1 is alive and well in its next generation called the Chevrolet Bolt. And there's been so much, yes, indeed, evolution of transportation and mobility. And as electric motors have become more efficient, smaller, et cetera, cheaper, they've been able to be applied in different manners. So you see, in this whole context of electrification of the vehicle, you see the transformation of so many different industries and subcomponents of mobility, which is exciting, which we talked to before, this interdependency with utilities. And I really like Hank's comment with respect to kind of national energy security by utilizing domestic sources.
Mm-hmm.
Electrification of the vehicle is all about making the energy and electricity at home. And the more we can control that and diversify it, not only from coal or natural gas, but wind and solar. And how do we do that? Because they're not necessarily cheaper, some of these new technologies, because, again, they're at the front end of this technology adoption curve. We need additional and continued policies at the federal level that support long-term investment in these newer innovative technologies that spin entrepreneurialism. They create new curriculums at the college level for jobs. It's the sting effect. So I really do see that what we are now experiencing in the electrification of the vehicle is this buildup of change that's occurred in mobility that has been able to break through, and I have to tell you, in large part due to energy security issues.
Yeah, I do think that's a huge piece of it, and I mean, you watch China. China is investing $15 billion in their electric car industry, in design, in creation. That's a huge influx of capital to create an industry that somehow America should be doing, but we're not.
Yeah, they've got a Chinese car company called BYD, which some people thought was build your dreams. Others said it's bring your dollars. It's like, whoa, there goes our money if it all goes to China. Let's build those in this country.
So tell us where we are now. We keep talking about this, but how many people can buy an electric vehicle? How much does it cost? Where do you buy one? Who's making them? Ford, GM?
I can speak to the Volt.
I guess you can. Go ahead.
And if you would like to go out and lease the product, which a lot of individuals are doing, it's $350 per month, which puts it price competitive in the market today.
As my grandmother said, that's bupkis.
And speaking to technology adoption, if you want to lease for 3 years, 5 years, then you're guaranteed you're going to be moving into the next generation technology at the end of that lease.
So if you lease a Volt, or who else is doing them? There's Volt. What else is out there right now?
There's the Nissan Leaf.
Leaf
is an electric car again. And that again is available to be leased at about the same price point.
WeGo. Yeah, is an electric vehicle that's available for purchase. I don't know if it's available for lease.
Right.
WeGo.
So when you lease these cars, does it come with a battery they put in your house? A charger, I mean?
It varies. The strategies are sometimes the charging is in the vehicle. That is the components, and you just have a cable. For the Volt, you'll have the charging is outside. Kristen can tell us more about that. For the Leaf.
So the charger comes with a Volt?
May I speak to that?
Please.
The charger's on board the vehicle. The infrastructure is in place. Thank goodness we have 120-volt home plugs at our home.
So you plug it into your house.
That infrastructure's in place. You just have to plug it in. You don't need anything more than what's really already there. There is a wish, and I'll like to have, faster charging. So that's when we move into the product that Mahi speaks to, level 2 charging or faster charging.
So Mahi, go ahead.
Right. Yeah, and that's, essentially when you say level 1, it's, your 120 volts, which is your, wall socket. But at that level, for instance, with a Nissan Leaf, with that car, it would probably take between 18 to 20 hours to charge your car up. So with level 2, that's the 240 volts that can deliver between 50 and 30 amps, you can actually bring that down to between 4 to 8 hours. So that's the big compelling advantage of having a level 2 chargers. That is the ability to charge your car quicker. And that's the one thing that we all need. You don't want to be, you don't want to plug your car in and then wait for 20 hours. You want to plug it in, and 2 hours later, it should be fully juiced up.
Most people don't drive their cars all the way to zero, though, whether it's gasoline
That's
or
true.
Electric. So for many people who drive electric cars, it'll take less time than that to bring it back up to a sufficiently high level,
right.
Maybe 80, 90% full.
Absolutely.
I'm one of those guys that has a bad habit of riding on E. And Brian wanted to know how much they cost. I think we just said that. They cost about $350 a month, the lease. Is that what we're saying
right.
at the moment?
For the lease.
But how much are they going to cost once they get on the market? How much are they going to cost us? I mean, if there's a Tesla RAV4, if the Volt really becomes a mass market car, how much are they going to cost?
Well, right now the Volt's costing $41,000 minus the $7,500 federal tax break, so that's around $33,000. Is that right, Kristen?
Right. Plus there's a $2,000 Maryland state tax credit, mm-hmm. so that brings it down to close to $32,000.
So, but right now they are not affordable for the mass of Americans.
Well, you'd be surprised how many people would be willing to pay $30,000+ for a car. I mean, there's BMWs, there's Porsches, there's all sorts of cars that cost more than that.
But most people buy cars that range between $15,000 and $20,000+. if they're going to buy a new car, they buy a used car for less, because that's the nature. I mean, that people don't spend, most people in the real world do not spend $30,000 to $40,000 or $50,000 on a car.
Right, but right now the price point is that it's appealing to people who have maybe a little bit more money. But as we make more of those and the price comes down, then it will be available for Joe Sixpack.
Right. And,
well,
and
not even Joe Sixpack. I'm just anybody, any regular worker, somebody who teaches at Morgan State University, somebody who's, you know, people who live on $50,000 to $60,000 to $70,000 a year or less do not spend that kind of money on a car. And that's most Americans.
Or you pursue the leasing option.
Right.
Right. That's where they'll be looking to the leasing option, because that is more price competitive.
So do you see in the future the electric cars coming down where they were, where they cost $21,000, $22,000 like a Honda does, like a Chevy would or whatever, that they're going to come down to a price that people can afford?
Before you know it, the Chinese are going to bring one to the market that costs that. It'll be probably 2 years from now. Yike.
I do. And related to the battery technologies that we were referring to.
Right. As the price of batteries, you know, comes down, if it continues coming down on this curve, like I said, in 3 to 4 years, you will actually go into a dealer showroom and you will have the option of buying an internal combustion engine car or an electric car, and they'll both be at the same price point.
So very quick, I do want to get a call in here. Where are your plug-ins real quick? Where are you putting them in now in your company?
We're putting them in, you know, in a bunch of locations that essentially is, the first sort of large-scale rollout is really being driven by the Maryland Energy Administration and by BEVI. And so we're installing them at a bunch of locations, all of them public, available to the public. And these locations will be the BWI Airport. It'll be various locations in Baltimore, Howard County, and I guess what else
about
am I leaving
nine,
out?
Nine jurisdictions that we're describing as EV ready. The emphasis for, and this is stimulus money, ERA funds, which the Maryland Energy Administration was very progressive about dedicating to electric vehicle support and infrastructure. So we chose to favor public sites that were along the spine, what we describe, at least for starters, I-95 highway, recognizing, though, that, you know, you'll want to be at a park and ride at a location where you'll be parked for a longer period of time because these are level twos. So, yeah, Montgomery County, Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Frederick County.
Annapolis?
Howard. Yes, Anne Arundel, Annapolis.
Well. Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller in here before we end the hour. David, you're on the air from Gaithersburg.
Hi, I live in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and I'm interested in leasing one of the new electric cars, possibly a Volt, but I have to wait about a year to get one. Still, I'm looking ahead to a point where there'll be lots of different electric cars running around Baltimore, and the need for tourists, for example, to find a place to plug in. The biggest problem, as I see it, and this reminds me from when I used to drive electric cars in California, is that you might have four or five cars all contending for a single or perhaps two chargers available in the parking garage. I could very easily see this happening down by the harbor here in Baltimore. And I just wonder, what incentives are there for parking garage operators to put these chargers in great abundance? Mm. And wouldn't they have to considerably heavy up their transformers and so forth in order to do that? If that's true, then what kind of incentives are there here in Baltimore to do that? And will we need greater incentives in the state of Maryland to make this happen?
Mahi?
At this point, I think the state legislature is considering some incentives. There is, of course, there is a federal tax credit of 30% for all, you know, charging infrastructure that is installed. In addition, the state is also considering, you know, putting in some level of tax credit in order to bring down the price point. Again, it is, you know, early adopters. You'll first start to see these, and we're actually installing this in a few garages. We're installing small numbers, you know, 2 to 4 units. But as I think as the number of cars starts to grow, you will start to see this incremental momentum where, as long as it makes economic sense, you know, these commercial parking lot operators and so on will start to put more chargers on, you know, on the ground.
Well, this has been a great beginning discussion. We look forward to having you all back again and seeing how this develops and really kind of pushing this. And I think we need to push it. This and rail is something that has to be our future if we're going to survive. And I want to thank Jill Sorensen, Director of the Electric Vehicle Initiative for Baltimore, D.C., Bevy, for being with us. And
thank you, Mark.
Good to have
great
you
to be here.
Charlie Garlow, who builds his own and is a Bevy board member, has been fighting this for years. Mahi Reddy, CEO of Semiconnect. And Kristen Zimmerman from the Volt Infrastructure Team at GM Research and Development. Thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
And thank my friend Bill Clark for introducing me to you all. We'll take a really brief break and come right back. On their way there, let me remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, go to www.mecu.com or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. We'll be right back. Stay with us as we talk about another kind of electric, General Electric, and why it and so many other companies in this country don't pay income taxes. We'll be right back.